truly with Harry Cooper of SharkHunters.com, and we'll tell you shortly how you can join and avail yourselves for free of one of the marvelous books on the Shark Hunters Library. So sit tight for that. Okay, Harry, by the way, has members all around the world from many different military services, many countries. It's open to everyone, and it is it's extraordinary. All right, let's go right back to picture number... Where are we here?
Eight, yeah. The only way I know is because that's the one I left up on my screen. Otherwise, I would have forgotten it.
That's A8 is right there, and it's...
Right, that pretty much a layout of Antarctica and some of the places where they dropped...
The markers.
The markers there around Neuschwaben Land, which was also penciled in by Feldwebel Schultz.
As if he knows where these things were dropped.
He is not just a researcher. He's
much more
than a researcher.
I was being only semi-facetious. He knows where these were dropped. I mean, he's drawing them in places that are relatively exact. All right.
Yeah.
Very good.
Yeah. He and Peter Parker both, well, now he's older, but he and Peter Parker, spooks, government spooks.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Which government? I'm not going to say.
Mm-hmm.
So here we are, A9. That is just a better, closer, sharper picture of the South Pole, Antarctica,
mm-hmm.
with all those... I keep looking for Cooper Land there, and I don't see it.
Well, I'll write it in later for you.
Yeah, that's where we'll land our V6 JU390.
Right, right.
And why are we on so much on South the Antarctic? We'll get to that later on.
Yeah, now the yellow that...
Yep.
Feldwebel Schultz colored in there. That is apparently that is the chunk that Germany claimed as its own, and that is the chunk that Grand Admiral Dönitz said that they had established an impregnable fortress. I'm paraphrasing for the Führer that he would be perfectly safe in.
Referred to it as Shangri-La. Now there's some question, did he mean Neuschwaben Land or did he mean San Carlos de Bariloche?
In terms of climate and overall livability, I would vote for the latter. But
yeah, right. Yeah, I don't think I'd want to live out my life down there in the Antarctic.
No.
I've been to Bariloche several times, and it's a beautiful area.
Yeah.
And digressing a little bit... at least four sitting American presidents went to San Carlos de Bariloche during their terms. Eisenhower in 1960, Carter, Clinton, and early this year, Obama.
The Oreo cookie himself went down there. Now, what in the world, you ask yourselves, would four presidents go to what used to be an extremely out-of-the-way...
Yeah,
almost
700 miles southwest of Buenos Aires.
Almost verboten out of the way. In fact, it was verboten. And why would they go down there? Now, did they meet with a very famous man and his wife? We don't know.
We are still trying to zero it in. We don't know. We're trying to zero it in. but with tongue in cheek, we'll say that Jimmy Carter... probably went down there because he thought he was going to Atlanta and got lost. He was the dumbest president we ever had.
Or Bill
Clinton, they probably told him that Monica Lewinsky was waiting for him down there.
Or a lot of cocaine, one or the other.
I don't know about that.
Eisenhower in 1960.
We've got a picture of him standing there.
In front of a building that you recognize, I think.
That's a very, very upscale, high buck
hotel.
Lodge,
whatever.
It was built in 1938 with German money. They had a fire, rebuilt in 1939, and it's spelled LLAO-LLAO. But in Argentine Spanish, which is different from everybody else's Spanish, it's pronounced xiao xiao.
Huh.
And when I've been there a couple of times, brought some groups down there, we had brunch there.
Yeah.
They're looking at $40 for a simple brunch, but it's a magnificent place. The rooms are like $400 or $500 a night, so we don't stay there. But it, you know, what are these guys doing there?
Do we know if the other three presidents after Eisenhower who visited there went to the same?
They went to Xiao Xiao. Yes, all of them went to Xiao Xiao.
They went to the same building, the same lodge.
Yeah, same lodge. Well, it's the fanciest thing down there.
All right, I understand.
But why? I mean, what the heck? It ain't like it's the Côte d'Azur. It's not like it's Monte Carlo. It's
Well, you gave me an idea, and I ran with it, and I think you're right.
Yeah.
And I don't know if we want to talk about that or not. But
no, we don't talk about that on the air yet.
I wouldn't, no. But I think there was a reason for it.
Yep.
It wasn't accidental, and yeah, very good.
They went
all
there
right.
Looking for the V6 airplane.
They should have called me.
Yeah, they didn't know you bought it off of eBay.
That's right. Before there was an eBay, I'm way ahead of the game.
That's right. And before eBay said anything with a swastika, they don't deal with it.
God, can you believe it? Yes, you can. All right. We know who runs.
I tried selling something on eBay once, and it was a total disaster, so I stayed away from
it.
Well,
we all know who runs eBay and who owns it, so you expect that.
What can I say?
Nothing, nothing. Let me say it. I'll get in trouble.
Okay.
You won't.
Yeah, this is your show.
All right. Now, it's our show, and all of you out there are included. That's the way I look at it.
There you go.
A9, we looked at. There is the location. A10?
Right, A10 and A11. A10 is the simplified that Feldwebel Schultz is hand scribbling again, too. He's a brilliant guy, but he's not a good artist. This is the Bunger Oasis, and at the far right corner of that thing, there was a DDR station, East German station. And then A11 shows you a little more about the Bunger Oasis.
Where is the Bunger Oasis?
That I don't know. I have to look at all this paperwork.
Approximately.
Down there on Antarctica.
It's supposed to be in Antarctica.
It's in Antarctica, yeah, and it's red and yellow sand.
Really? All right,
yeah,
no ice.
Those little circles that he draws there are uh-huh. kind of like oases with trees and green stuff growing.
Wow.
And he said this is where, in whenever the heck it was, the 1990s, I think, the astronauts were training. Yeah, here it is. In the late 90s, they were practicing there for the Mars landing.
You mean they had the rover and they were practicing dropping it from altitude?
Yeah, they were
maybe
practicing
and
navigating, walking around it.
All right, well, they remember, we haven't officially been on Mars, so this would have had to have been the rover.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
the Mars rovers.
Yeah,
all right.
So
now this
planning.
Why don't we have pictures?
Obama got there and said we don't need NASA anymore.
Well, we don't need America anymore. Let's not stop with NASA.
Well, that's his mission, in my opinion. But let's
you are absolutely right. All right, the Bunger Oasis.
Yep.
The Bunger Oasis. Are there not pictures of this online? Have you looked? If you've got a place in Antarctica with greenery and sand that duplicates Mars, well, I'm going to look it up now and see what I can
find.
Yeah,
and I can get a hold of Feldwebel Schultz, too. This is no excuse, you know, looking back to my old sergeant, no excuse. But after I got back, well, you know this, after I got back from Europe, mm-hmm. I had a letter from the VA saying, oh, by the way, when you fell off the roof, you also broke your back. So I'm sitting here right now with a compression
yeah.
fracture of a T12 vertebrae. I was back for only about 1 week, and because I'd been gone so much this year, well, I promised my family I'd take them away, so I loaded up my 4-ton, 36-foot-long travel trailer, and we went down to Sarasota.
Mm-hmm.
So I lost another week there. And then when I was unloading it back here by my house, I was backing it in. I live in the woods, you know. And I felt a little bump. I figured out, so what? Just back up. Well, turned over. That turned out, you know, those things that stick up out of the ground for the telephone thing. Well, they don't stick up out of the ground anymore. It's flat here. Mm-hmm. Then I went to unhook my trailer, and part of the suspension still had a really, really strong load, and the thing snapped and busted open the heel of my hand. So I'm trying real hard to kill myself, I think.
Well, I suggest you calm down a bit.
Yeah.
I'm looking at pictures.
I'm so far behind.
It's all right. Bunger Mountain is what they're looking at here. Now, Harry's right.
Training program of USA crew in the 1990s.
I'm looking at pictures that are astounding. They look like the Mojave Desert. They look like Mars. Let's just tell it straight. They look like Mars. Extraordinary. Now, there's some other pictures here. There's been development here. There's old wreckage laying around. There are pictures of, more openings. Those triangular-looking openings.
They had lots of tunnels over there.
Yeah, and so
if you want to be a nice guy, email those things to me when you can, please.
I will. I certainly will. Yeah. There's one picture I've got to pull up here. Blue Bonnet Oasis. Oh.
There are several oases down there. There's another one, a Schermacher Oasis.
Mm-hmm.
But that's in another area.
Wow. Okay. Very interesting. I'll send you some pictures here. All right.
Appreciate it.
Onward with the tour here.
Onward with the tour. What do we got next? Okay. Now we say, Auf Wiedersehen to Feldwebel Schultz, and hello to another fellow, and I don't even know how to pronounce that name, Navigador or some such thing. These are, here I'm shuffling paper around, these are some of the items he has. I'm going back to visit with him in Europe later on. Mm-hmm. September, October. The first thing you see, B1, that's the report of the Deutsche Antarctic Expedition, 1938-1939. This was published in 1938-39, or thereabouts.
Uh-huh.
And he has all four volumes of this with the maps and the pictures.
Wow.
So when I go back and visit, I'll bring my camera and shoot bunches of pictures of this. From what I understand, stuff like this is no longer available anywhere. It's been suctioned up and gone.
Now, the next picture, B2, very interesting. It's a U.S. Army document made apparently about 8 years after the expedition by the Germans in 38-39. This took place in 1947, the infamous Operation High Jump.
High Jump, yep. And we just found, first off, he has all five volumes. I had no idea these things even existed anymore, but he has all five volumes from High Jump. Now, one of our members, Captain Max, is all I'll say. He was executive officer on board USS Barb under Gene Flood, the most highly decorated American submariner ever. And Lucky was here to visit me. I saw he had a Levanter, four Navy crosses, just an incredible guy.
Hmm.
And this guy, Captain Max, was his XO. And that's nice. Captain Max took some videos, which he sent to us, of the last three war patrols of USS Barb, and we thought that's where the story ended. Oh, about 5-6 months ago, he said, oh, by the way, I was also executive officer on board the Senate during Operation High Jump.
Wow.
Oh. So I asked him, tell me more about High Jump. I got an email back. Oh, it was a long time ago. I don't remember anything.
Yes, sir.
So I said, yeah, okay, fine, horse pucky. So then he started remembering, and he's sending me more and more information on high jump. He hasn't gotten into the real meat of it yet. My biggest question, why did Bird need an aircraft carrier, a small one? Why did he need a submarine? Why did he need combat troops when it was only going down to make maps? So we're still trying to get that information.
Absolutely. Wow.
We don't have that yet, but he lives within a reasonable drive of my house, so I think I'm going to go visit him.
Somebody else you need to go visit, too. We're working on that.
Yeah, I was going to go tomorrow to visit the guy you and I are talking about, but the Republican headquarters for my area is opening up tomorrow morning, and so I'm supposed to be there. I'm part of the Republican Executive Committee, so it wouldn't look good for me not to be there. Bad enough this evening, I missed the annual dinner for the place where I've got a 28-year-old special needs son, and this place is just a godsend, and so they have their annual dinner, and I decided to stay home and sleep in preparation as a radio marathon, but donated to the 100,000.
Nice.
I'm trying to get my schedule back. This year has been upside down something fierce, but we're learning a ton, and I know he's not listening, but there's a fellow named Jack Goodyear, who's a member since 1986, I think it is.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever I'm going to take off on one of these expeditions, Jack sends a very fat check so that we can do that. So no Shark Hunter's money is used for these expeditions. Jack is just a great guy. He's an angel.
Yeah.
So God bless him.
Indeed. Well, I second that. Thank you very much, Jack.
Yeah. So then we move along. He's got this guy, Navigador, has all five volumes of High Jump. Now, what else do we have here? Okay. Now we have something from the British Library, and I didn't put in his handwritten notes here. on this one, the British Library, it said the South African government promised to give him their seismographic readings of the 1958 nuclear explosions, but before he delivered it, before they delivered to him, as they told him, their archives were blown up to avoid communist access. So
now,
he asked the British Library.
Just so you folks know, during about a 10-day period in 1958, three atomic bombs were lit off in the same area in the Antarctic. These weren't tests. There was a tactical reason for them. One report says that they were high altitude. If so, they may have interrupted electromagnetically things on the ground. We don't know if they were dropped on the ground, ground burst. I don't think so. From everything I've read, they were air burst, and they were up high. Why, I don't know. So maybe it was just to tell the Russians we can get to you anywhere we want with our weapons.
Who knows? Three in 10 days. And by some sources we got, they were about 300 miles up, which puts them in outer space.
Outer space. That's almost, why even talk about the Antarctic if they're that high? It doesn't matter.
But we're not sure that's where they were.
That's right.
They were probably not a ground burst. You know, that was my career field when I was in the service, was thermonuclear weapons, bombs. So, then the next one, before, the person here said in the second paragraph, there have never been any nuclear tests by the United States or any other country conducted over or near to Antarctica.
This is November 2000. Isn't that kind of a lie, Harry?
He penciled in at the bottom, here we have written proof of how the Allied bootlickers lie. Because now you scroll on back, and now you see B-5, and Captain Marshall Hall tells all about these detonations.
He says,
the second paragraph, he says, fortunately, these nuclear weapons tests have been assessed, etc. And I got about 10 pages of the testing data that behind it, fact sheets, etc. Low yield. Okay, here we go. It says the ships of Task Force 88 were the anti-submarine carrier USS Tarawa, the destroyers Bears, Warrington, and the DE's Courtney and Hammerberg, and the Oilers, Neosho, Salamone, and missile trial ship Norton Sound, and the seaplane tender Albemarle. It says the low yield, 1 to 2 kilotons, that is very low yield in today's market, were lifted to about 300 miles altitude by rockets fired from the Norton Sound. Detonations occurred at such distances above the Earth that there was no possibility of exposure of task force personnel to ionizing radiation. There's about 6 or 10 pages of that stuff here. So
it's pretty hard, Harry, excuse me, but it's pretty hard to really even assume that at 300 miles elevation, these bombs would have any effect at all on the Antarctic. That's
it would
awfully
have
high.
No effect down here, especially 1 to 2 kilotons.
Right.
The one that we dropped on Hiroshima, not Hiroshima, like these dumbass liberals want to pronounce it, it's Hiroshima. That was 10 kilotons, and these are 1 to 2 kilotons.
Right.
So that's really not much of anything. And in a hydrogen bomb, you need about a 10 kiloton nuclear detonation to set off your 15 or 19
the big boy.
Megaton.
Thermonuke.
Right, you have to go past the crush area to the tritium and all that stuff, tritium and deuterium. So anyhow, according to the dolly at the British thing, nope, there were no tests. According to the U.S. Navy, yep, there were tests, and here's all the documentation.
I think what we can say is that they safely say that these tests really weren't targeting anything in the Antarctic. They were just done, generally speaking, above the Antarctic.
Right. I think they were just plain tests of nuclear weaponry.
Right.
In an area where it couldn't bother anybody and nobody would even see the flash in the sky. If
correct.
You could see it up there, I don't know. But I suppose if it lit off in the middle of the night overhead, you'd see it.
That's still outer space, though.
It is.
No.
But we had, I'm remembering way back in the early days of the space program. They sent up a balloon that got to be about the size of a dirigible way up there. And it orbited about every 90 minutes. And you could see this thing up there with the naked eye. So, and then here we have a chart prior to the war, I believe, showing the German colonies. And there was a bunch. And I took it upon myself to circle the island of Trindade.
Remember
that one?
Sure do, yeah.
And with the line and the arrow down towards Buenos Aires and Mar del Plata. And Trindade, for those who did not listen to that show, that was the island that's owned by Brazil. That is the island that's owned by Brazil. And Brazil took their people off the island in 1938 so that the Neuschwabenland expedition could use it. Then in 1941, the Germans left, and the Brazil Navy came back. And in 1945, when the war was over, the Brazil Navy took their people off the island. The Germans came back and occupied the island for at least 2 years. Now, this is a small island, but it's got lots of creeks and streams, 2.5 miles long, 1.5 miles wide, and goes up to 3,000 feet, roughly. And herds of goats and pigs and sea turtles. So when a ship would come by needing fresh water and food, they'd pipe off some water and they'd go and whack a bunch of goats, and they had food for the rest of the voyage down to Buenos Aires.
As I said earlier, tens of thousands of Germans were able to get out of Germany at war's end and after war's end, and it looks like this was the pipeline. This was one of the stops on the pipeline.
Right, that's what the Allies called the Rat Line.
Mm-hmm.
they'd be coming out of Vigo, Spain. Not Vigo, but actually up the river from Vigo, there was a little place called Villa Garcia. And that's where Don Angel Alcazar de Velasco came out on board a submarine with Martin Borman and made it all the way down to Puerto Coig on the southern end of Argentina, down almost to Tierra del Fuego shortly after the war.
And don't forget, these people were all leaving Germany with the full knowledge of the highest levels of the American government, because we had made a deal with Germany.
That's pretty obvious. And the U.S. got all the nuclear secrets and got a lot of hardware and got tons and tons of scientists, engineers, technicians,
9,000 of them at least, and we got a whole space program out of it. We got rockets to the moon. We got tactical, strategic, intercontinental ballistic missile technology. We got it all.
Right, and if you'll remember, I told you some two or three shows ago, we have a list of thousands of these scientists with their name, their address in the United States, what company they worked for in the U.S., and how much money they got paid. They didn't get paid a hell of a lot of money, I guess, but, you know, $100 a week back in 1946, 47, not bad, I guess.
That's probably worth $1,000 a week, easy.
Something like that, I don't know. My dad worked for the post office, and he wasn't even making $80 a week back then.
Uh-huh.
Of course, our first house in a suburb of Chicago was a two-story, all-brick Cape Cod with double dormers in the front, one big dormer in the back, a basement, a fireplace. The whole thing cost $8,000 to build.
Mm-hmm.
$8,000. It's worth probably $250,000 today.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Well. So anyhow, that's B-6. And let's look to B-7. B-7 is just another layout of Neue Schwabenland up there.
Yeah, okay, we got that. Now, let's jump, if we can, if we're all done, to Witkowski and Cooper sitting together. You can tell which one is Harry Cooper. I won't tell you how. I don't want to give it away, but you can tell.
You have to be blind not to know, because the names are on them.
Now you gave it away.
And, excuse me, that, in my opinion, that is a photo of two of the top researchers in the world.
No question.
In their fields. Witkowski, I don't think there's anybody better than Witkowski with the Die Glocke and the German secret weapons. And when it comes to the U-boats and Hitler's escape, I think that's me there.
You got it.
He was a gracious gentleman, a researcher, and I just helped him out with some more stuff for a paper he's doing. Gave him more information about the South American and the landing of the V2 truck. It was called the truck. The JU-390 was called a truck because it was so huge. So I gave him information about that. And the picture, remember the picture of the lady with the three swastikas tattooed on her arm?
Yes, it's funny how that happened. It must have been mosquitoes down there.
That's right. Them Zika mosquitoes got her.
Yeah.
And also I sent him a picture of the old lady that actually heard the plane landing.
He must have liked that.
Yeah, he's a very nice guy, and his English is excellent. So we had a very good meeting there in Warsaw.
Mm-hmm.
So what all did we talk about? Geez, I just threw those papers back onto the pile here. Let me get these papers up. We were pretty narrow focused there, Igor and I. We talked.
How free was he in terms of giving you information? What was your sense of it?
I think he was totally open. I don't think he held anything back. Like I didn't hold anything back when I was talking to him. You know, we're both researchers and we respect one another in our relative fields.
Right.
And no, I don't think he held anything back. There, you know, we were only together for about 3 hours, So,
I see.
The, you know, 3 weeks, we still wouldn't have had it all done.
Of course. Did you look at my video yet?
Which one?
The one with the apparent black and white footage of a flying disc, a German disc, and then all the pictures, several dozen pictures. It's quite a compendium of pictures of the flying disc program the Germans had in the 30s and 40s.
Okay, no, that's still on my
okay.
Emails. I'm down to only 60 emails left.
All right.
When I started,
well, this is
I
only
like
about a 8 minutes, and you got to look at it.
Okay.
I took that. It's like a 6 second clip, black and white footage. I don't know if it's real. I can't prove it. But I had my editor enhance it, colorize it, do all kinds of things with it, and you'll see it, and then you'll scroll below that, and there are several dozen pictures of German flying saucers. You want to call them saucers? Fine.
That
it's obvious.
Flying devices.
Flying technology.
Yeah, there you go. So, in our three-hour conversation, he was giving me the locations of many of the bunkers and tunnels underground, one by a place called Flytrap, which had a huge underground bunker compound, and apparently that's where the Glocke was. And we talked about the Ju-390, which was in Thuringen for a while, and the connection between Antarctica and the research going on in the Owl Mountains. You know, these are just...
Well, I mentioned
points.
The Owl Mountains after finding them. You already knew about them, but, I mean, that is an astonishing underground. And you people who understand the idea of labor camps, World War II concentration labor camps, when you study the Owl Mountain complex, that was just one of many... You'll understand why they needed every able-bodied human being they could get to work.
Yeah,
they were building things under the ground that are astonishing. Just around Berlin. What is the area? Two-thirds of Berlin is underground or something like that?
A huge amount. And when we take tours over there, we go into a part of it called Berliner Unterwelt, into some of the bunkers and tunnels underground there that had been used for bomb shelters.
Sure.
We also go into the underground command post, which had been for the DDR, the East Germany, huge big underground command complex, and all the desks and chairs and bunks and computers, everything, they're all hanging on springs from the ceiling, and the rooms are mounted on gigantic rubber blocks. Excuse me. So, you know, if you get a nuclear shock, it still doesn't wreck it, and it, you go in there, and it's just like they walked out yesterday. There's even documentation. There's folders and binders of paperwork just dumped on the side. So I think we're going over there again next summer. Yeah, I haven't been there in a while, so people can come to Shark Hunters. Send us an email at sharkhunters@earthlink.net and ask for information about our tours. Because we go places nobody else can go. I've learned that Eingang verboten means shark hunters are welcome here. And we go places like that.
Yeah, you do.
Yeah. Now, Igor was telling me about all the underground stuff, as I say, by Flytrap, and also in the Owl Mountains. Now, I was just talking to another one today. There's another mountain range that he told me about, a different guy, that I have to check that out, although it's still got military guards. I don't know why. We'll find out. And then either by Breslau or Bratislava, there's a huge bunker complex underneath a big monastery. I have to go check that out soon.
Now, when we talk about Owl Mountains, some of the chambers that were dug under the ground were, I believe, 30 meters tall. They were huge.
Yeah.
They were designed
to
put entire factories in there, and they did move at least one factory into them. They didn't get them finished. Most of the tunnel projects under there, less than 1% were reinforced and finished off with concrete before the war ended. But they were building enormous things under the ground.
they ran out of time.
Yeah.
So, and who knows, maybe it's just as well. Otherwise, the war would probably still be going on.
Well, I don't think so. If somebody had used his alleged atomic bombs and hadn't been scared off with the claim that, well, if you use one, Germany will be toast, the war might have ended up much differently. And we wouldn't have had 60 years of the Cold War and Stalin and all the massive numbers of people who perished. God.
Yeah, Stalin was such a nice guy, wasn't he?
Uncle Joe. Yeah. Now, there are a lot of people who will tell you, and they're not necessarily pro or anti anything. They'll just tell you as a matter of historical reality that we fought the wrong enemy in World War II. And you know who knew that? General Patton.
Patton was one. Yeah,
he knew it. And they killed him for it after the war.
Yeah. Well, not only for that, he kept wanting to rearm the Waffen-SS.
He had three divisions that I heard.
He wanted to march east into Soviet Union, but also he kept asking embarrassing questions like, what happened to the $3 billion worth of gold that disappeared out of the Reichsbank? That's, you know, you start messing with money, and you can wind up on the wrong side of a funeral.
They kill people all the time.
Oh, yeah. People are expendable. Fortunately, I'm not important enough for anybody to take a shot at me yet.
Yeah.
We hope.
We hope.
So now, some of this, I'm going off my notes. Some of this came from Witkowski. Some of it came from another guy, but...
tell us what Witkowski said about Die Glocke or anything else. He's the expert that you can share.
Yeah, I'm still trying to figure out. He was very guarded, trying to figure out where the hell Die Glocke wound up, where it went, who took it, who sent it, and he always ducked that part.
According to Clark McClelland, the Kecksburg UFO was an advanced version of Die Glocke built by the Soviets. So they got some of the scientists who were involved with that, and it was out of control, and it slowly meandered over Canada down into the U.S. and crashed at Kecksburg, Pennsylvania.
Right.
Clark McClelland was ordered by Dr. Kurt Debus, a director of NASA, to fly up there as quickly as possible with an unnamed German scientist. He has not named that German scientist on the air. Clark knows. I think it was Heinz Kammler. But we'll see. Anyway, they went up. Clark walked up to the object, as did the German that was with him. Clark put his hand on it, pounded on it to see if there was any noise coming back from the inside. His guess is that it was an advanced version of Die Glocke that was able to fly and end up crashing in Pennsylvania. So he went back and reported to Dr. Debus, and then the German that was with him gave an extensive report, a much bigger report, Clark said, after Clark's report. So there you go.
Well, if he gave a much more in-depth report, then that means he had a much stronger engineering background.
Or he worked on it when it was in Germany.
That could be too, yeah. Which could very well be Hans Kammler.
That's right.
Kammler was an interesting guy, and only three photos of him are known to exist.
I have all three of them in that video.
Okay, yeah. Kammler was, for those listening who don't know, he was a doctor of engineering. He was also a Gruppenführer, which makes him a general, four-star of the SS. He was in charge of all the secret projects, the Die Glocke, the atomic power, the atomic weapons, the jet fighters, the rocket fighters, the Type 21 submarines, just everything that had to do with spookworks, he was in charge of it. And his headquarters was the Škoda plant in Prague. And after the war, the Škoda plant made cheap, crappy little cars. It was not much different from the old Yugo, if you remember those things.
Oh, I do remember Škoda.
There you go. Now the Škoda makes a really fine car. I don't think they're coming over to the U.S. yet, for whatever reason, but I rented one when I was over there in Europe. It's really a nice car. They've come up in the world. So,
well, it may have been Kammler, and that's one of the things I need to find out from Clark. I want to get him back on the program. He is, for those of you who are concerned, he is still alive. I found that out. I still can't raise him on the phone or on the internet, so I don't know what's going on exactly.
Same here. I've sent him emails. Nothing comes back. I called him and got the voicemail and said, hey, look, we're worried about you. Call me up. Tell me go to hell if you want to. Just let me know you're alive. Still haven't heard from him. So I'll go knock on his door one of these days.
All right. Well, we want him back on.
Hope he doesn't keep a gun near the door.
He won't do anything. Just
I know.
Tell him that I would very much like him on the program as soon as convenient.
Okay. I will pass that on to him. Okay. Within the next week, I should be over that way.
Very good.
It's only about 40 miles from here, and there's a great German restaurant right near his house.
There you go. Okay.
So, okay. According to either Witkowski or one of the other guys I talked to, I'm looking at my notes, there were plans to build U-boat bunkers in Feuerland, which is at the bottom of South America. But they say only one was built. I have to go look for it.
They built one. It may be there then. It probably is.
Oh, yeah, if they build them, what do you do with them when you're done? I don't know what
too much to demolish.
Were, but
costs more to demolish it than to build it.
Oh, yeah. I don't know what the specs were, but looking, I've been in the one at Brest and at Lorient, and when you build something where the walls are 7 meters thick, steel-reinforced concrete, when you're done with it, you just walk away from it. 7 meters thick, that's 24 feet thick, the walls.
Yeah.
Jeez. Gottfried Sandstedter, who was the guy trying to build these bunkers, he was based in the Antarctic, I'm told. Condor 1 and Condor 2 missiles were developed in Argentina, meant to deliver nuclear warheads. As the war was going badly for Germany, Germany tried to recruit Argentine soldiers to send them to the Eastern Front.
Yeah.
I can't imagine anybody signing up for that one.
No, one-way ticket to oblivion. The Eastern Front, the Germans literally could not, this sounds horrible, they could not kill the Soviet hordes fast enough. Their machine gun barrels were melting. I mean, they literally couldn't do it because the Soviet technique was to send human hordes forward. They weren't allowed to go backwards. You turn around, you got shot in the back by one of the commissars behind you with a submachine gun.
That's what I heard. Be nice now. Remember, I was a commissar of the Soviet Union back in 1991, but they never gave me a machine gun.
And
I wasn't supposed to shoot anybody in the back. That was something that the CIA thought would be a good idea.
Right.
Then I've got some kind of, holy smoke, I got some fancy letters and numbers here. It's some kind of a file I'm supposed to dig up. Huh. Well, I'll look for that tomorrow. Late war and post-war, the Argentine Navy was closely watching the evacuation of Germans. Now, you said a lot of Germans went down there, and that's correct, but there were others, too, besides Germans. There were Croatians, lots of Croatians, fascist or Third Reich, whatever you want to say. You remember the leader of the fascists from Croatia, a guy named Ante Pavlik. He went down there, and he wouldn't even surrender, even after Germany surrendered. He finally had to get forced out of power. So he went down there, and he got a job as a bricklayer, and then through mutual friends, he met Juan and Evita Perón, and suddenly he owned a huge, big construction company, and he built buildings that are still standing down there, skyscrapers in Buenos Aires. One of them has a huge, big iron image of Evita.
Hmm.
25, 30 years ago, it was illegal to mention the name Perón or Evita.
Hmm.
Now, she's like a saint.
Hmm.
And the Peronista party is, I think, the biggest one down there.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. I'm also supposed to check into the Chilean Navy because Chile and Argentine navies were watching each other. Yeah, that happens. After Perón fell, a lot of people moved to Paraguay. Remember, dictator there was Stroessner.
That's not much of a Latin Stroessner. Whatever,
yeah,
Stroessner.
Right.
Yeah.
Nice old German.
Uh-huh.
Something else I learned from this person that I didn't know. Of course, there's a lot I don't know. I'm still learning. Japan had a small Secret Service contingent in Argentina, which I didn't know.
Oh, interesting.
Because they needed the vanadium and the tungsten and the rare metals,
mm-hmm.
which was critical for their war effort. And let's see. Flytrap was 180 meters deep. Ooh, boy, that's pretty big. And I'm supposed to be looking for flytrap. The research in these mountain laboratories went on until late April 45. There are 820 or more underground facilities in Germany. Some began in the 1930s to hide the military buildup.
Mm-hmm.
20 million cubic meters underground tunnels and bunkers. And some of these underground bunker facilities were mines that had gone bankrupt.
Mm.
Okay. Now, let's see, where else am I? We're about to go into my next picture down there. Excuse me. Look at D1. We have D1?
Yeah.
Okay. I landed in Nice, France, which is where they had all this problem a couple of days ago, and they had a chopper waiting for me.
Who's they?
This belonged to a relative of Prince Albert, who owns Monaco.
Right.
And so then D2, those pointy, the white pointy roofs down there, that's the heliport. And off to the left is the yacht basin as we're flying in. Beautiful flight. And D3, they're dragging my bags out of the chopper.
Uh-huh.
And we'll get into why I was there in a minute. Then, of course, there's D4. There's me in my tuxedo doing the James Bond routine
now
in
look
the
at
casino.
That.
Yeah. Doggone. What an incredible place, Monte Carlo.
What did you do in there? What was the purpose of you being so dressed up there?
Well, you gotta be dressed up to go into the casino.
So that was the casino I'm looking at.
That's correct.
Okay.
And I was also supposed to have an audience with Prince Albert, but his schedule got changed. We met with a lot of his people.
Uh-huh.
Then, of course, the bottom picture, D5, shows that it really is tough work. This expeditions and expedition work is not easy.
Well, you need a vacation after that kind of work.
Yeah, I suppose. Wonderful, wonderful people. I'm not supposed to identify who any of them were.
Or still are.
Are. But I looked like I was enjoying myself there.
How
Very
can
nice
you tell?
People.
How can
yeah.
you tell?
Now,
I count 1, 2, 3, 4, 4 or 5 of Cooper's fingers and thumb. Oh, never mind.
Yeah, you're looking at Miss Daniela. There you go.
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow, before we switch gears on this, if you want to tell your listeners how they can get free books from Shark Hunters.
Yeah, this is a really a special opportunity. If you want to join And I hope you do, because the monthly information coming out of the magazine is extraordinary. Well, let me tell you, Wendy, we got to take a break here. Go look in guests again under Harry Cooper's name and look at books. Look where it says books and take a look at all of those books. It's right below photos. You'll see it. Load that page of books up, because you can take your choice, a free book, simply by joining sharkhunters.com. And there are some knockout books in that selection. A free book if you join. Go ahead.
And also, current existing members have a free book, too. Just extend your membership.
There you go.
You know, another year. So we don't want to freeze anybody out of the free books.
Very nice. All right. We'll be right back and go over that in just a few minutes with Harry.